Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. As you can tell, we are in a modified and somewhat compressed mobile studio today. We are very pleased, though, to be able, as a result, to catch up with one of our most important colleagues and comrades in arms in the fight for our freedoms. He is the Director of Homeland Security Programs at the Center for Security Policy. His name is Kyle Scheidler. He's the author of a book that I think has caught a lot of people's attention, including that of Senator Ted Cruz, who had Kyle appear as a witness in one of his very important committee hearings in the Judiciary Committee a while back. The book is entitled Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. And Kyle most recently has published in just the past couple of weeks an important sort of complement to that program about another organization or set of organizations, I guess it's better to say, Understanding Black Identity Extremism, Considerations for Law Enforcement is the title of this new book. And we're going to be talking with him about it in the course of this hour. Kyle's expertise and his insights are greatly valued by all of us. And we're very pleased to have a chance to expose all of you to them now. Kyle Scheidler, welcome back to Securing America. It's great to have you with us, sir.
Thanks for having me, Frank. It's a pleasure.
So introduce this term, Black Identity Extremism. I'm not sure it's familiar to even our pretty erudite audience.
Well, the term is actually not mine. The term originally comes from the FBI, which used this term to describe a variety of different Black radical organizations that they were linking to a series of ambush attacks against local law enforcement. This was in the wake of the BLM riots in 2020, but they really traced it all the way back to the Ferguson riots in 2014. And what they were noting was that there was a correlation and an uptick in attacks on law enforcement coming out of this subset of extremists. Now, when one of their intelligence documents about this threat became public, they took a great deal of political pressure, primarily from the Congressional Black Caucus, but also from a number of left-wing media sources. And basically, the FBI folded like a cheap card table. They abandoned the use of the term Black Identity Extremism. They came up with some other euphemism, which is extremely generic and doesn't even explicitly state what kind of group you're talking about anymore. And they've completely ran away from the term. So what I tried to do with this book was to see if there was actually any validity of the FBI's original premise, which was that you could describe some of these groups which were engaging in these attacks on law enforcement in a cogent way. Is there any connective thread that runs through these various groups? And what I have found is that indeed there is. Indeed, there are a variety of ideological and historical threads that connect these groups together, that influence the way they see the world, that influence their political objectives, and that influence the kinds of criminality and kinds of violence that they do engage in when members of these extremist groups engage in violence. And so my goal was to provide this background information to law enforcement to give them a better chance of understanding the foe that they face.
Implicit in that input is that they're not getting the sort of information that you have marshaled from outfits like the FBI. Is that correct?
I think it's quite correct. We've seen, for example, that the FBI, as I said, ran away from this term, despite doing a number of pretty decent intelligence products about Black identity extremism when they were facing political scrutiny. They ran away from it. And so law enforcement aren't getting that kind of education. Additionally, the kind of education they are getting about groups that fit under this umbrella is oftentimes incorrect. For example, There is a subset of what you might call Black identity extremists known as Moorish Science, or the Moorish Science Temple of America. Now, these are African Americans who believe that they are a member of a nationality group known as the Moors that come out of North Africa. This is obviously historically incorrect, but it is the sort of background story that they have invented for themselves. And as a result, they believe that they are not required to adhere to American laws and that they are not American citizens, but Moorish citizens. This results, as you can probably imagine, in a number of conflicts with law enforcement, as they refuse to carry driver's license, they refuse to get registration for their cars, and these sorts of events. Now, federal law enforcement has essentially called Moorish Science members sovereign citizens. But this is incorrect. And the reason it's incorrect is because the sovereign citizen movement began in the 1970s. And Moorish Science Temple of America has been doing these kinds of things, including issuing national ID cards to so-called Moorish Americans, since the 1900s. So they have been doing this almost 70 years earlier than the sovereign citizens, and yet you have the FBI, you have groups like the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center that attempt to lump Moorish, so-called Moorish citizens in with a sovereign citizen movement, even though that makes no historical sense.
Interesting. And Kyle, are there other examples of Black identity extremism that we ought to have in the mix as we think about the implications of what they're up to?
Sure. So the Moors are probably the earliest example of what you might call Black identity extremism. Out of them flows a group that most of your listeners probably are familiar with, which is the Nation of Islam. But we look in the book at the roots of the Nation of Islam, what they believe and why they believe it, and importantly, how this results in their engaging in a wide variety of violent and extremist behavior, ranging from, for example, close ties to the terrorist supporting regimes of Sudan and Libya back when Muammar Gaddafi ran Libya, all the way to attacks on law enforcement and a very famous set of killings in the 1970s known as the Zebra Killings that were conducted by members of the Nation of Islam. So we trace all of those sorts of relationships all the way up to the modern day, where you had a individual attack Capitol police officer with his vehicle, ran a police officer over, and then jumped out of the car with a machete and was killed in that attack. And he identified himself as a follower of Louis Farrakhan, the leader of Nation of Islam. And so we look at that. But we also look at the impact that Marxists and explicitly the Communist Party of the United States have played upon Black identity and the Black movement in the United States, what they would call the Black liberation movement in the United States. And this also goes all the way back to the very founding of the Soviet Union. The Bolsheviks began seeking to use disagreements and the tension between Black and white Americans against America as early as the 1919-1920. And so we trace that route all the way up through what would eventually become the Black Panther Party, their obsession with Mao and his guerrilla tactics, all the way through their affiliation with Castro's Cuba, with the FLN of Algeria. And as we start to head into the modern era, you get modern BLM and their affiliations with, for example, the Venezuela of Chavez and Maduro. So another important thread in all this is the foreign subversion angle and the impact it has had on Black Americans and the Black identity.
We're going to come back to the foreign dimension of this. Enemies, foreign and domestic, it turns out. Kyle Scheidler is with us, the author of Black Identity Extremism, Uncovered is another way to put it, Uncovering Black Identity Extremism. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The recent spate of pro-Hamas riots is just the latest reminder that under Joe Biden, America no longer has a functioning counterintelligence capability. For example, we have no idea how many tens of thousands of Chinese Special Forces warriors have entered our country through Biden's open borders, ditto jihadists, or the extent of the weaponized Muslim Brotherhood or other infrastructure with which such invaders have now married up. We have individuals with ties to Hamas, Iran, and Communist China in extremely sensitive government jobs, including Joe Biden himself, and in Biden's case especially, the FBI, which is charged with countering such internal threats, has instead been serially covering up his compromise. Worse yet, the FBI, Department of Justice, and intelligence community have been told patriotic Americans are the enemy. Unless fixed, all of this will get a lot of us killed. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're visiting with Kyle Scheidler, our colleague at the Center for Security Policy, where he directs the Homeland Security Program. He is, among other things, the author of a very important new book, Understanding Black Identity Extremism, Considerations for Law Enforcement. And Kyle, in the previous block, you talked a bit about some of the groups that fall under this descriptor for the FBI, but you introduced a very important topic, which is the external sources of support that some of them have. I'm particularly interested in some of the work that you've done, but also that our colleague Trevor Loudon has done in connection with the self-professed Marxists of Black Lives Matter and the Chinese Communist Party through two different front groups of the CCP, Freedom Road Socialist Organization and a splinter off of it called Liberation Road. Can you tell us about all of that?
So the Freedom Road Socialist Organization and its splinters is a very interesting part of the early formation of the Black Lives Matter movement. All three members of what you might call the founding triad of BLM came out of the Freedom Road Socialist Organization in one way or the other. Importantly, they had as a mentor a man named Eric Mann, a former member of the Weather Underground, who was closely affiliated with that organization. And you can see in the formation of BLM, and of course their primary, you would say, sort of leading figure that they cling to is Assata Shakur, the Black Liberation Army cop killer who's now free in Cuba. And so you see in BLM the roots of the very long process of foreign subversion that took place in this country and really reached a peak in the heady days of the 1960s and 1970s. You know, in the 1960s and 1970s, you had the formation of the New Left, which was a very radical, very aggressive leftist approach, sort of breaking with what they viewed as the stodgy old guard of the Communist Party USA. So they were increasingly attracted to, for example, Maoism and radical approaches like that coming out of Germany with the Red Army faction and Marxist autonomism. So you had a new and invigorated radical left in this country. And that is the roots of BLM. Their thought process, their leadership, they were raised literally in Marxist high schools where they were taught activism and organizing from their very early days. So you have in the formation of BLM a group that could not do anything other than what we, of course, have seen it do, which is engage in promoting incitement, in promoting violence against law enforcement officers. You know, that comes right again out of their history of the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army. So this is, and that is, I think, one of the key messages of the book, is that everything that we see today is part of a historic moment that began long ago. And we are seeing the outgrowth of decisions that were made and individuals and their thought process that began a long time ago. And BLM is a perfect example of that.
But would you say that it's basically out of the playbook of the Chinese communists as well, and that the help that they are getting from the Chinese communists and the extent to which they are following that playbook, this is in the service of that most dangerous of external enemies, the CCP?
I mean, if you go back to, for example, the Black Panther Party's formation, every member of the Black Panther Party was required to own a copy of Chairman Mao's Little Red Book. They were required to studiously study his rules for guerrilla warfare, including five rules for the People's Liberation Army, which included things like, you know, do not even steal a grain of rice. So it was a bit of a strange situation that you had, you know, these urban Panthers from places like Oakland marching around talking about how they weren't going to steal the peasants' grain of rice. And that goes to show you, of course, how engendered they were with this Maoist ideology. And it deeply, deeply affected them, and it still affects their outgrowths today. So there is a very tight ideological relationship. And then, of course, there are also economic relationships, support relationships as well.
Kyle, let me pivot again to some other forces at work here. I think I mentioned earlier that you've written a previous book on Antifa entitled Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. What is the nature of the relationship between BLM, for example, or these other black identity extremist groups and fascistic entity, though it professes to be anti-fascist?
Sure. Well, in Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat, one of the things we emphasized was Antifa's roots in the new left terrorism in the 1960s and 1970s, specifically the May 19th Communist Organization, which was an organization which, among other things, engaged in the infamous 1981 Brinks armored car robbery, the 1983 Senate office building bombing. So it was a legit terrorist organization of its time, as was its predecessor, the Weather Underground. And if you understand the history of the Weather Underground and the New Left, they very much understood their purpose as supporting and defending the Black liberation militants of their time, the Black Panther Party and then the Black Liberation Army. They were tightly, tightly linked together. To be a radical in the United States was to support the Black Panther Party. And so today you have Antifa, which views very, very, very much its role as supporting BLM, of defending BLM, engaging in violence on behalf of BLM. And if you read, for example, a Forming an Antifa Group manual, which is available online, they will say explicitly that Antifa chapters have a responsibility to cooperate and support BLM. So they view themselves as a sort of shock troops for Black liberation militants. And we still see that today. Very, very tight relationship. And it's an ideological relationship. It's also a relationship based on funding and support.
Fascinating. And I guess it's fair to say that when you talk about shock troops, they're part of the violent arm and capabilities of these Black identity extremists. Is that right?
It's absolutely right. It's an interesting inversion from the 70s, actually, because in the 1970s, what you saw was groups like the Black Liberation Army were the militant wing. They were the ones with guns, robbing banks, blowing things up for the most part. The sort of white radical groups like May 19th Communist Organization played a supporting role. They smuggled weapons. They provided identification. They helped set up safe houses. They moved money around with the help of their radical lawyer friends, for example. And what we see in our modern aspect is almost a reverse of that. It's Black Lives Matter, which received the lion's share of the money, you know, millions and millions of dollars flowing in to the Black Lives Matter Global Foundation to support various activities and protests and so on and so forth. And
from corporate America, among places, other places, right?
And it is the predominantly white anarcho-communists of Antifa who are the leading violence creators and the guys who get the headlines to advance the agenda.
Literally, so shock troops in every sense of the word. Kyle, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to get into another element of, ideological collusion, if you will, but also foreign involvement. And that would be from what we call here at Securing America, the Sharia supremacists. Kyle Schadler is an expert on that topic as well, and we'll visit with him about it on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and Kyle Schadler is with us, I'm pleased to say, for this full hour. We're talking with him about a subject that has got to be on all of our minds, and that is the increasing, rising violence that we're hearing and seeing in cities across America. Among other impetuses for it is the calls for, jihad. From groups like Hamas that are at the moment being severely attacked by the state of Israel, having launched an invasion against the Jewish state. And Kyle, I'm very interested in the extent to which we are seeing from abroad in these various Sharia supremacist nations and organizations. And Sharia, of course, is, as you know, Kyle, so well, is the sort of genetic code, if you will, of Islam. It is not fully embraced or followed by all Muslims, yes, but the authorities of the faith say it's the real practice and direction for practicing it. And unfortunately, a whole variety of dangerous elements, including Hamas and Hezbollah and the Taliban, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and on, do conform to these supremacist dictates of Sharia. So what connection have you been able to establish between such entities and well, nations for that matter, and these black identity extremists?
Well, your audience may have noted a story shortly after the October 7th massacre of Israelis by Hamas of BLM chapters actually promoting flyers featuring Hamas hang gliders which was the method by which the terrorist organization infiltrated Israel to conduct its slaughter. And so it was a quite explicit statement of support for murdering Jews and for attacking Israel. So why would a self-identified black liberation organization see in Hamas an ally or a supporter? There's a couple of reasons for that. One, and we can get into this, is on the left side, the role of Soviet subversion in creating the Palestinian cause. Our friend and colleague David Wormser has written a very excellent report on that topic that I would commend to you, and we can talk about that if we choose to. And on the other side is the role that Islam has played in the black identity, and particularly among black identity extremists, going all the way back to the 1900s. You had in the Nation of Islam, and even before it with Moorish Science, this idea that there was a closer connection of the African-American population to Islam than there was to Christianity, which was the faith into which most African-Americans had been raised at the time. And so you get from this things like Nation of Islam's view that Christianity is a slave religion and Islam is a religion of freedom, and that all black men and women should be Muslims and are inherently historically Muslim. And of course, when they say that, they actually don't mean a traditional orthodox Islamic practice, but something different and heterodox. But it has created a very close connection. And in particular with Nation of Islam, you had after the death of Muhammad, the founder of the Nation of Islam, his son, Wallace D. Muhammad, took the majority of the Nation of Islam into out of their unorthodox view and into orthodox Sunni Islam. And when he did that, he was welcomed with open arms by members of the Muslim Brotherhood. And he would, in fact, end up having a seat on the board of the Islamic Society of North America, a Muslim Brotherhood front, for example. And so you do have... And there has been a great deal of effort on the Palestinian side and on the Hamas front side to educate Black Americans and to encourage them to believe that there is a close connection between what happens in Palestine, or in the Palestinian territories, I should say, and their views of what happens on the streets of America. So you'll see pro-Hamas fronts say things like, the IDF trains U.S. police officers to violate people's civil rights. This is not true, but it's just what they say. And there's similar ideological efforts to persuade Black Americans that what they see as their struggle is the same as the struggle waged by Hamas. And unfortunately, this has gone on for some time now, many decades, and they've been very successful with it. In promoting this kind of ideology, that there is a linkage between these two issues.
Yeah, there is a decided linkage between them, and it's evidenced in the response to these calls, as I say, from Hamas for action on college campuses and in the streets of American cities and elsewhere, in solidarity with Hamas and you know, the terrorist activities that it is engaged in. And Kyle, again, I'm struck by what would seem to be a three-part sort of liaison here. We've long discussed at the Center for Security Policy, as you know, the red-green axis, the radical left on the one hand, and the Islamists, if you will, the green of Islam. But there now seems to be a black component to it as well, these black identity extremists. And I'm struck, I know it's purely coincidental, but the main colors of the Palestinian flag, after all, are red, green, and black. What does it portend in terms of the likelihood that we will see, in the event of still further exhortations to violence in this country from groups like, well, Hamas, yes, on the one hand, but also its sponsor, Iran, and perhaps you know, other jihadis for that matter as well, to mobilize these folks from a more or less peaceful color revolution, if you will, to a full-blown and violent one.
Well, as I said, actually, there has already been a significant uptick in violence coming out of the BLM riots of 2020. That was really the genesis of the FBI's Black Identity Extremism intelligence, was to say that this the growth of this ideological movement, if you will, is having a direct impact on attacks against police officers. I think we will see an undoubted increase in that. And we're seeing a confluence in both ideology but also tactics. If you look at the behavior of Hamas-linked groups like the Students for Justice in Palestine, or of PFLP-linked groups like the Palestinian Youth Movement on the streets of America, they are now almost indistinguishable tactically from BLM and Antifa. They make the same kinds of statements, they use the same kind of language, they motivate the same base, and they engage in the same kind of riotous violence. We've seen videos of them pulling people out of cars during these pro-Hamas demonstrations. There was a very ugly riotous event outside Tulane University in Louisiana this week, for example. An event that I understand was affiliated with Students for Justice in Palestine. So you are seeing a confluence on the ideological level and on the tactical level. They are becoming increasingly like each other in imagery, in behavior, in language, and in tactics.
And Kyle, would it surprise you if the Chinese Communist Party, given the various ties that you've described and you know, sort of in the doctrinal aspect of this, as well as the linkages and money flows and the rest. In the event the Chinese Communist Party wanted to create upheavals in this country, which might be aided and abetted, by the way, I heard yesterday that there were some 24,000 Chinese nationals that have been identified by the U.S. government as having come into this country. I don't know for sure how many of those were fitting the demographic of particular concern, the military age, unaccompanied and seemingly fit and organized groups of Chinese young men that some observers describe as people who look a lot like People's Liberation Army Special Forces. But to the extent that those elements might be in the mix, do you think that we may be looking at a very concerted effort by these groups working together in the event somebody pulls the trigger and says, we need to light up the American home front?
You know, one of the things I did not understand fully until I started researching the book was the role played by foreign governments in supporting terrorist acts against the United States in the 1960s and 70s, particularly the Cubans, of course, were probably the lead element, but other governments as well.
Proxies for the Soviet Union.
And they themselves were merely pass-throughs for the Soviets, that's correct. And one becomes very concerned that you would see something similar here, or could see, or have already perhaps seen something similar here, where you have domestic groups that are very able and willing to take foreign money, foreign material, foreign training. We know Black Lives Matter participants have traveled to Cuba and other places where they could very easily access training, as their Black Panther predecessors did before them. So to worry about the fact that the Chinese Communist Party would seek to stick its hand in any kind of domestic upheaval has to be taken very seriously.
It does indeed. We'll be right back with more on that subject and a lot of other topics with Kyle Scheidler right after this. We'll be right back. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The recent spate of pro-Hamas riots is just the latest reminder that under Joe Biden, America no longer has a functioning counterintelligence capability. For example, we have no idea how many tens of thousands of Chinese Special Forces warriors have entered our country through Biden's open borders, ditto jihadists, or the extent of the weaponized Muslim Brotherhood or other infrastructure with which such invaders have now married up. We have individuals with ties to Hamas, Iran, and Communist China in extremely sensitive government jobs, including Joe Biden himself, and in Biden's case especially, the FBI, which is charged with countering such internal threats, has instead been serially covering up his compromise. Worse yet, the FBI, Department of Justice, and intelligence community have been told patriotic Americans are the enemy. Unless fixed, all of this will get a lot of us killed. This is Frank Affney. We're back. We are continuing this hour-long conversation with a very special guest, my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, where he directs our Homeland Security Program, Kyle Scheidler, the author of a brand new and very important book, Understanding Black Identity Extremism, Considerations for Law Enforcement, and for all of us, by the way. Kyle, one aspect of this that we've not touched on to this point is the help that these black identity extremists are being given under the guise of critical race theory and diversity, equity, inclusion agendas. Could you talk a little bit about how they fit into this mix? Who's, you know, advancing them? Is this a sop to these black supremacists, I'd call them? Or are they simply, you know, happening coincidentally in the same moment?
Well, I would say it's certainly not a coincidence, Frank. If you go back to the ending of this raucous period of the Black Panthers, the Weather Underground, the chaos of the New Left in the 1960s and 70s and into the early 80s, before they're primarily suppressed by a law enforcement action and just getting old and tired. But they never quit. They never gave up. What they did do was go into academia. Nearly all of these far-left radicals and terrorists played some role in academia. Gentlemen like Bill Ayers, of course, who played a very significant role in rethinking the way America approaches education in the United States. And
let me just say, gentleman is not the adjective I would generally describe.
What do you think you get when Bill Ayers designs your education program? You know, what do you get when every college in this country teaches Frantz Fanon, the French-Algerian revolutionary thinker that was a linchpin in the thinking of Black Panthers like Huey Newton? You get exactly what you have, right? You get division, you get chaos, you get a country that does not understand its own roots, it does not understand its own identity. And when you don't understand your own identity, that creates space for other identities, right? And so in that sense, black identity extremism really is the right term because it creates alternative identities to the American identity as an American citizen, as part of this great nation, which of course black Americans are. And so this is the space which the radical left has created in academia, which is now filtered down. It's not just professors anymore. It's K through 12. It's hard to find a school of education in this country which does not teach radicals like Paulo Freire and the like, who implemented this kind of ideology of divisiveness that we now see taking place.
So to the extent you're describing a phenomenon that is much more widespread in its application than just within, say, the Black community, are you just basically laying out the prospect that there will be far more foot soldiers throwing themselves into the, you know, agenda, or the, worse yet, the actions, the violent actions of these extremists of various stripes that we've described seem to be converging in a way that would pose a threat, a fifth column at a minimum inside our country, if not widespread, you know, revolutionary activity against it?
Well, I think that's aptly said. Anytime you have a sort of violent underground of the kind that we now see on America's streets, that means you have a very active radical above ground apparatus as well. They always go together. You don't get the violent terrorists without the apparatus that makes it possible. The education, the indoctrination, the training, the funding, all of these things happen out in public. And we need to start thinking about these things as a whole and not as a set of lawful activities by a bunch of crazy people who are maybe a little radical and some illegal violent activities. You actually have to think about them as a revolutionary element. The above ground, the underground, they operate together cohesively. They coordinate in various ways, sometimes conspiratorial, sometimes just ideologically. And if, as a member of law enforcement, you're not thinking about this whole package that represents the genuine threat to both national security, but also to the security of your local community, you're missing things. And that has, I think, long been the message at the Center for Security Policy, that we have to have a holistic understanding of these various threats, above ground, underground, and how they play off each other.
Yeah, how they work together, in fact, I think it's fair to say. And you've been a huge force for good in the work of that effort, as you say, at the Center for Security Policy over many years, Kyle. Let me ask you one other element of this, because I think it's critical to our understanding of the danger we face. And that is, you mentioned Bill Ayers. Bill Ayers was the man who, I believe, helped kick off Barack Obama's political career. They're close. Obviously, I gather there's been professions of not knowing each other very well and so on. But obviously, over the years, they and Bernadette Dorn and you know, Michelle Obama were all partnered up in Chicago. To what extent has that kind of affinity, shall we say, to say nothing of a close relationship between convicted terrorists, mastermind, you know, agenda setting in education? And I want to explore with you on the other side of this break what that might suggest about the attitude of the U.S. government, much impacted by, well, the first two Obama-Biden administrations and what I argue is the third of them, in which we find ourselves at the moment. We'll be right back with Kyle Scheidler to discuss that. Stay tuned. We're back, and it's our final installment of this fascinating and, frankly, scary conversation with Kyle Scheidler, who has most recently authored a really important book about understanding Black identity extremism, Considerations for Law Enforcement is its subtitle. And Kyle, before the break, I just was introducing this question of So where's the U.S. government in all of this? You started out by talking about the FBI calling this black identity extremism. We talked a little bit about how they don't seem to have been quite on top of this, as one would like, presumably in part of late because they're focusing on, well, people like thee and me, a lot of other patriotic Americans instead. But what is one to make of the fact that a man who went on to become president of the United States had this close relationship with arguably one of the seminal forces in the revolutionary moment in which we find ourselves? And how has that impacted, do you think, if it's operating, law enforcement, the justice system, and so on?
Well, I think Barack Obama is interesting as one of the first elites to come out of the educational and cadre system that was crafted by the New Left after their temporary defeat in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So you have Barack Obama, who is totally raised in this environment of academic Marxism and radical New Left theory. And he, in a way, represents, I think, the front line of the elites that we now see coming out of colleges, filling our U.S. government bureaucratic roles at every level. And so it's not really a surprise. He did, I think, in many ways, fundamentally change, as he promised to, the nature of America and its approach to the world, in part because those who followed him into government were, like him, products of this new left and this new left identity and approach to what it means to be an American. So it's no surprise at all that the Obama administration and the Biden administration after it took on a role of the police are the bad guy, not the criminals.
It occurs to me that in a way, Barack Obama epitomizes that red, green, black nexus, does he not? I mean, his background with the Marxists, his background, of course, with the black community, but also his background with Islam, all seem to be wellsprings for how he conducted himself and his administration, and even more so in the administration that he clearly influences, if not runs, even though he's not president any longer.
Yeah, I mean, he really is a poster boy for that kind of radical as a member of the elite. Whether it was, ties in Indonesia and Kenya and that, as you said, Islamic angle, you know, he made statements about how much he appreciated the call to prayer, these kinds of things. Or it was, if you read his biography, talking about hanging out with the Marxists and the ultra-feminists and everything in his college days. All of that, I think, was formative for him, as it was
and
for
Jeremiah
many of
Wright our on the black side. Reverend Wright, right?
Frank Marshall Davis, other prominent black communists. Yeah, absolutely. It really was an amalgamation of everything that was radical and yet at the highest levels of academia and elite American society for his raising.
So, Kyle, we've laid out here a very, very troubling picture. In your closing 3 minutes, what are you calling on, law enforcement for sure, but also just ordinary Americans who don't want to lose our country to any combination of these radical elements, black, red, or green?
Well, you know, we have always believed the Center for Security Policy that good policy starts from a good understanding. And so in understanding black identity extremism considerations for law enforcement, what we really wanted to do was give law enforcement the tools that they need to understand the world that they are seeing. I am not a police officer. I'm not a member of law enforcement. I cannot tell them on the tactical side how to approach the problem. But what I can tell them is how the their opponents see themselves, how their opponents view the world, and the things that they try to do to make the world that they desire come to pass. And so if you are a member of law enforcement or a member of the U.S. government at the state or local or federal level, and you take seriously your oath to protect your community, that starts with understanding. And we hope we have provided a tool for them to begin to do that.
Well, I think you have. And to the extent that we have an understanding of this problem, presumably I think engagement that is needed to push back against these color revolutionaries, or however you want to describe them, is thereby enabled. And does that best express itself in things like, the old Homeland Security line, if you see something, say something? Is it engaging with your members of Congress to enact legislation such as they have in Louisiana now on the books about racketeering, involvement in trying to bring law enforcement's attention to bear against these kinds of activities and
organizations. I'm going to steal a line from the left here and suggest that people should think globally but act locally. Understand these threats that are affecting your country on the national level and indeed the international level, but then act locally. Get to know your local school board. Understand what's going on in your child's school. Have a good relationship with your county sheriff. Encourage them to consider that they do have a role in keeping the community safe from some of these national security threats. And everything we talked about today, the subversion, the terrorism, these are national security threats. They ought to be dealt with at the federal level. But if they're not, then it has to flow down to the state and local level.
Kyle Schreidler, thanks for the work you're doing and helping that flow down and so much more. Follow Kyle at the Center for Security Policy's website, securefreedom.org, and here, of course, at Securing America. Kyle, thank you. Come back to us next time, folks. Until then, go forth and multiply.